Welcome to today's Trial Lawyer Nation. I'm your host, Michael Cowan. I'm here with my partner, Mallory Peacock. Mallory, how are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm excited to be back on the podcast. I feel like it's been a while.
It's been too long. And we're going to start a new trial series, and we're going to spend the next few months going over helpful tactical trips that you can use in your trials. And today we're going to start with the 30-minute witness. Why do you say the 30-minute witness, Mallory?
So this is one of my favorite topics, and I know we've talked about it on the podcast a couple of times, doing a short witness for trial. So how do you keep your witnesses short? And we call it the 30-minute witness because in mine, in your opinion, Michael, every witness should be on the stand for 30 minutes or less, if possible. Now, that's not a blanket rule for every witness, every time, all the time. But I think in our last few trials, I can't think of a witness that went over 30 minutes, honestly.
Yeah, the only one I can think of, I think in our forklift product liability trial, I think one of our experts may have been on more than 30 minutes because we had a lot of teaching. But in general, we put the vast majority of your witnesses on, especially in a trucking case where things are a little simpler, to be quite honest, in 30 minutes or less.
Right, right. You know, I don't know who said this, and I would love to give credit to whoever said it, but if it requires a lot of explanation or it requires longer than 30 minutes to explain something, you haven't simplified your case enough for people to understand it. And it's not a simple case anymore. And we can't win cases that aren't simple.
Absolutely. When you're explaining, you're losing. Now, sometimes there's some teaching that needs to be done, but you really do need to work to go and simplify that. So let's talk about, first of all, why. Why is it important at trial to keep your witnesses,
So the main reason is attention of the jury. So most people can't pay attention to something, especially lecture style testimony, which most testimony is. It's mostly lecture style. Most people can't pay attention to that for more than 30 minutes, really probably more than like 15 minutes. But, you know, usually need more than 15 minutes with an expert to make sure that, you know, you get all of the things that you need for your case. And so that it's not overturned on appeal. But really, it's the attention span, and you don't want to bore a jury. People on the jury see things on TV shows that last 30 minutes, and the whole trial is done, right? If you watch a Law and Order episode, they have the investigation through the trial done in an hour-long episode. And so that's the expectation of a juror when they come in. I know I had a jury duty a couple of weeks ago, and it was a really eye-opening experience. I didn't get selected for the jury. I was really, really disappointed. But a lot of people in there, I was shocked by how many people in there thought going to jury duty would be only that day, that they would be selected, done, trial complete, all within the single day that they were called for jury duty. Almost no one in there realized that this is just the first day. There's going to be a lot more to this, and nothing is going to be done in just this single day. And so that was really surprising.
Yeah, I think it is really important, you know, to get to the point, to keep things simple, to show what's important to the jury, and then sit down and stop talking. Why do you think some people do longer directs and won't just do a witness in 30 minutes and instead take 2-3 hours with one witness?
I think there's a couple of issues. One is fear. I think that's the biggest one, is fear that you're not making the point you think you're making, fear the jury isn't getting it, and fear that you're not going to say something that you wish you said. And so fear, I think, leads a lot of it. Also being unprepared. So to do a 30-minute witness, a lot of preparation is required, because you have to make sure that you're asking all the questions, that you've prepared with the witness, or even for a cross-examination. So you're not preparing with the witness, but you're preparing yourself. And then, you know, I guess the last thing is just organization, right? That you just kind of start going and you forget where you are, or you forget what the witness was saying, or you're not taking good notes because you're not really prepared. And so it just keeps going on and on and on. So I think those are really the three reasons I can think of. What do you think, Michael?
I think fear is really the biggest one. I think we're just afraid that if we don't over-explain, if we don't repeat things over and over again, if we don't put out every possible piece of evidence we think that might help us. And the other thing I've seen some lawyers, I don't know what it is, they feel like they have to include every fact that's related to the case, whether that fact helps them or hurts them. They just feel like, well, it's part of the case. It's part of the story. We have to get it in there. And you don't. I mean, you can tell a simple story. The defense can tell their story. And if the fact doesn't move the ball either direction, then you can leave it out. It's not being deceptive. It's just not being confusing. But I think there you need a certain amount of preparation and confidence in your story to do that.
Yeah, I think, too, that there's the idea that if it's not complicated or if it's not a lot of work for me, then I'm not doing my job, right?
Right.
Like if it's not, if I haven't done all this speaking in the trial, then I'm not being a lawyer. I'm not talking enough. And really, the more that the lawyers are talking in a trial, I think the worse that you're doing, because you're not a witness and the jury isn't there to hear you pontificate, ask long extended questions, you know, give your two cents, have constant objections. I mean, that kind of stuff really, really turns off a jury. So you're doing too much, I guess. Just doing too much.
Absolutely. Well, how do you make sure you're not putting in too little evidence and then suddenly you get a directed verdict? Or you lose your case on appeal? Or you didn't convince the jury because you didn't put in enough? How do you make sure that you get enough without going on too long?
So I think I've heard this at every single CLE seminar I've ever been to, is you have to start with the jury instructions. And it sounds so elementary. And the first time that I heard someone say that, I thought, okay, well, the jury instructions are really simple in a negligence case. I mean, this isn't some complex contract dispute or where there's a lot of definitions or there's a lot of whatever, but that's true. It's a simple instruction, but you need to make sure you have evidence of each element of your claim. And so you do that by looking at your jury instructions and seeing what the elements are. And then usually what we do is we draft an order of proof where we say, okay, we have these witnesses. They're going to cover these topics. They're going to cover these elements. So if you have an expert witness that's an accident reconstructionist, well, that witness is going to talk about breach of duty, right? What happened in the crash? Do you need an expert on duty, right? Is it a trucking expert where you have to explain why a trucking company has a duty to train drivers or something like that? That's not something that's obvious to a juror. And so you go through each element and you assign a witness that element. And one witness can have more than one element and one witness can only have a piece of an element, right? It's not that you have to get the whole case into a single witness, which I think people fall in that trap too, where they feel like every witness has to talk about every element of every single thing. And that's because you haven't mapped it out. I mean, that's really, you do that because you haven't thought about how are all the pieces of the puzzle going to come together.
And this is boring, but I think you have to not just look at your jury instructions, but you have to look at your state's case law as to what quantum of evidence you need, what type of evidence you need to support various elements of damages and to support the kind of numbers you're hoping to get. It doesn't mean you have to go on forever with the witness, but you do want to make sure that you get, you know, for example, in Texas, if we want to have mental anguish, we have to show, you know, a substantial disruption into someone's life, not just a minor worry, inconvenience, harassment, but, you know, a true disruption in their daily routine. And so when you know what the standard is, then you can go ask those questions and get those stories to go show that. And whereas if you didn't, then, you know, you may not quite get there. Because like I said, you don't want to be in a rush. Like you don't want to take forever with a witness, but you also don't want to seem like you're rushing through the trial. You're asking questions really fast. I think it's just this confidence of, I know my story. I'm going to tell my story. I'm going to stop talking. It really helps.
Well, and when you know the case law, Michael, you are just a case law genius. You have a memory for it. You really do. And for me, I have to look it up almost every time because I want to make sure I get the words right. There's no harm in asking a witness, have you had a substantial disruption in your daily life? If that's what the case law requires you to show, you can put those words in your question. You can put those words in there just to make sure you feel comfortable that you have the evidence and that you got what you need to support your verdict on appeal and make sure that you actually ask the right questions. So going through identifying the case law, identifying keywords that you know, your appellate courts have said, we really want to hear someone say that they're ashamed, or we really want to hear someone say that describe the pain like this. Then, you know, if that's true for your case, you want to make sure that comes out explicitly in the testimony.
It can also help you with the witness preparation because, you know, like these are the things that get you there and these are things that don't. You ask the witness when you're doing prep. One of the things the courts consider is this. Have you ever seen any examples of this? And if you haven't, you haven't. You don't tell them what to say. But, you know, it gives you, it lets you know where to go looking, because the witnesses, they want to help you often, but they don't know what's important and what's not. And again, they want to go tell their whole story. And, you know, you have to convince them, like, you're not the only witness in the case. This is your, like, you're really good at saying, like, this is your role. You're here to talk about this. And it really takes a lot of pressure off them too.
It really does. No, I find that when you tell witnesses, okay, here is your piece of this, and you reassure them, we have all the other pieces. Don't worry. It's not all on you. This is the only piece that you have to tell of this story. It's like a huge relief to them. And they do so much better on the witness stand, because they feel like, I'm just going to do a really good job at this one thing. And especially lay witnesses. Experts, I mean, it's not as big of a deal, but with lay witnesses, it's a huge deal, because they feel so much pressure. They don't know what to expect. They're scared. And when they feel like, I'm just going to focus on doing this one thing really good, it comes out in their testimony and they do a better job. But even with experts, you have to tell them what their role is. What are you here to say? And what are you here not to say? What are you here not to talk?
I think it's super important with experts, because there's a couple of things with experts. One, a lot of them think they win and lose our cases for us. In their mind, they're going to go up there, they're going to sway that jury, and they're going to, you know, they have this ego thing, which, you know, I guess maybe it helps you to get up and testify if you have that ego, but I don't think it's true. I think at best, an expert gives the jurors the tools they need to come to the conclusion. They're not that persuasive because they're being paid money to testify. The other thing is, a lot of times experts want to talk about all the things that they think are important in the case, or every violation they found, whether it's a strong one or a weak one, whether it's persuasive or not. A lot of times, some, like trucking experts, they'll want to bring up a lot of violations that didn't cause the crash, and you can lose the jury by being ticky-tack with that. So I think it's really important to sit there and work with your expert. Like, this is what's important in the case. This is what we're going to talk about. You know, this is your role in the whole thing. And to me, you know, the liability expert, the biggest thing is to teach the rules that the defendant should have followed and where those rules come from. So in trucking, you're talking about what the regulations are, what's in the commercial driver's license handbook, our CDL manual, what's in various other industry publications, and why. What are the rules? What are the reasons for the rules? And then whether, you know, it doesn't hurt to go ahead and have the expert say, and based on my review of the evidence, the defendant violated the rules. But I think that's really a lot less persuasive than arming the jurors for what the rules are. I've almost wondered whether it's worth even having the expert give the opinion on the violation. Because I just, you know, I've seen some lawyers just put up an expert and just have them start giving conclusions. And I just think that's just not persuasive at all.
Yeah. I mean, the other important piece of the 30-minute witness is it's more persuasive. It doesn't feel like you're just throwing out whatever you can think of. And if a jury thinks that you're just throwing out whatever you can think of, they think you don't believe in the case. They think that you don't understand what the case is, or they think that it's a long shot. And once the jury gets in their head that your case is a long shot, or you don't believe it, or there's a question in your mind about something, then it's almost impossible to come back.
Yeah. I think another thing that allows you to do, you know, a 15 to 30 minute witness is to have a lot of them. So we do a lot of personal injury, wrongful death work. It's what we, not a lot of, it's what we do. And so, you know, we don't want our clients and paid experts being the main evidence of our clients' harms and losses. We want to have other people, friends, family, coworkers, neighbors come in and talk about it. So if every witness can have one or two stories, you know, preferably one before, one after the injury, but it could be one, but just, we had a case where the same people, his coworker, he had one set of coworkers before the injury and another set, he got another job months later after the injury. And so we had to have two different sets of coworkers to do compare and contrast with them. But when, you know, you're here, you know, you've got a great story about, you know, the yard being different. You have a great story about the time that his kid wanted him to pick him up and he didn't do it. And the kid was crying and, you know, and you saw the look of pain on his face and you felt so bad for him. Whatever it is, you get those couple stories that you can tell with each witness. And then that way the witness only has to remember that stuff. You can be very persuasive, but you just keep the case moving. It's more interesting to hear five different people talk for 15 minutes than one person talking for an hour and 15 minutes.
Yep, I definitely agree. And then your eggs aren't all in one basket. So sometimes witnesses tank on the stand. They get too nervous. They forget what they were supposed to talk about. Even if you've practiced, they forget what you practiced and they just don't do a very good job, or they come off really unlikable and you didn't expect that, right? And it just happens. And so if you have all your eggs into one witness and they come off really unlikable, or forget what they were even talking about, forget they even ever knew the person, or whatever happens, it's okay because it was one witness out of five or one witness out of 10. And so it's not going to make or break the case, which also helps the witnesses, right? I tell witnesses that all the time. You're one of 10 witnesses. So I tell people, if you screw up, you're not going to ruin the case. If you mess up, if you panic, if you get nervous, it's going to be fine. I don't think that's going to happen, but you're not going to ruin the case. And guess what? When I tell people that, they're less likely to panic. They're less likely to freak out. They're more comfortable because they feel like the pressure's off. So telling them that and naming the feeling, right? You feel overwhelmed. You feel nervous. You feel like, what if I ruin this for my best friend? What if I ruin this for my coworker? What if I ruin this for my mom? If you tell them you can't ruin it because it's not just you, it goes better.
Now, you do something to help the jurors keep track of what all the various witnesses are saying and, you know, what that's relevant to. Well, tell us about that. We can use a King flip chart.
Yeah. So I'm not the only one. Michael does this too, but and I learned it from Michael. You know, jurors think that they're going to remember everything that's said on the stand. They just think, I'm paying attention, I'm going to remember. You have note takers, you have not note takers. You don't know what they're writing down. You don't know if they're writing down what you really wanted them to take away. So I actually take notes for the jury as people testify, and I do it on a big King flip chart with markers. And especially this works well with any kind of witness, an expert witness, an eyewitness, a lay witness, a damages witness. It works consistently every time. So let's say, I'll give an example. Let's say we're talking about damages, and this witness is going to talk specifically about mental anguish and pain that they've seen this person go through. So I'll take the King flip chart. One sheet will say pain at the top in black marker. The next sheet will say mental anguish, because these are the things that the jury's going to see on the jury charge. They're going to see the word pain. They're going to see the word mental anguish in Texas. So that's why I use those words. Then I'll pick up the color for the person. So let's say witness one, you're going to be purple, and everything you say, I'm going to write down in purple. Not everything you say, the things I want the jury to remember that they said. And so the first question's about pain. Keywords that they say about pain, I'll write down. They'll say, you know, one time he was bent over and crying because his back was hurting so bad. I'll write bent over and crying, right? Just so the jury has something to remember. Then for mental anguish in my purple marker, I'll write whatever they say about mental anguish. The next witness will write on the same piece of paper, but with a red marker or blue marker, different color, and use a different color for each witness so the jury remembers, okay, one witness said that, one witness said this. The idea is to fill up the page, right? You want to fill up the page with words so that it looks big, important, a lot, right? You want to make it look like a lot that they're going through. And then in closing, you use those notes that you took for the jury to remind them about what they heard and who they heard it from. I found that it works well, and people remember specific key phrases. And that's what you're arming the jury with, those specific key phrases to go back and say, well, they said he was bent over and crying. I mean, that seems like a lot of pain.
Absolutely. I think one thing you do so well is you also put it in context for the jurors. So you're not just asking the questions to elicit sympathy, but you're like, one of the things the jury is going to have to consider is what amount of money will Fairlane compensate, you know, Sally for her pain. So I want to ask you some questions about her pain, and you write pain up there. And so then they get it. You're not just doing it to pull their heartstrings. You're giving them what they need. And then you're writing down what you think is important. And then if the witness says something silly, you don't write it down.
Right. You don't write down what you don't care for the jury to remember. And it's crazy. What you write down is what they remember. And so it's helpful. I do have people come up and say, does a judge really let you do that? And I'll just say, first of all, I've never asked. I just do. But I've never had anybody say no. So I don't know. If in your jurisdiction you think you can't do it, my suggestion to you is just do it and see what happens. There's no rule that I know of in any jurisdiction that says that you cannot create demonstratives while people are testifying. And that's what you're doing. You're creating a demonstrative actively while people are testifying. That's all that it is.
In Texas, we found there's, you know, actually case law that says, you know, a summary exhibit that summarizes and even emphasizes your testimony, if the witness proves it up, is admissible, actually could go back to the jury room. And that's, I think, one thing when you start doing is putting, Lisa Bluh used to do this when I'd watch her try cases in the late 90s. She would put exhibit stickers on her posters and, you know, on her flip chart things and send them back to the jury room, get them admitted. And I think that could be a great help to them because they could have it back there. That one you have a little bit more of a fight over. Yeah, I would say 98% of the courts I've been in front of have let us do this. Occasionally you have a judge that just isn't going to let you do it because they don't want you to do it. And then you just have to adapt and do it a different way.
Yeah. And, you know, if you know that your judge isn't going to let you do it, so they've already told you or something like that, you know, one of the things that you can encourage the jurors to do in your opening statement is to take notes. You know, I think some people are afraid to have jurors take notes because they're afraid they're going to write down the things that are against you. But you have to remember they're going to write down the things that are for you too. And hopefully the way that you've presented your case, it's easier to take notes because you've thought about, well, I want to make sure I'm highlighting key words. And so I might ask a witness again, you said he was bent over and crying. Then the jury says, oh, okay, that's important to Hirschau. I'll write that down. And the defense isn't thinking about this. They're not thinking about how repetition helps people remember things or how repetition shows the jury what you think is important.
Now, I think to do the witnesses in 15 to 30 minutes, I think the use of visuals is really important so that we can be clear. We don't have to spend more time than needed explaining, and it can be more persuasive. What do you think?
I completely agree. And one of the things, Michael, that you are so good at, and this is a real challenge for me, and I think for a lot of lawyers, is if you want to keep your witness in 30 minutes, your visuals have to be so simple. Because if it takes 10 minutes for the jury just to read a single slide because you have so many words on it or so many things or it's so active, or 30 minutes to just explain one exhibit, well, then you're not actually helping keep it short. So how do you make sure the visuals are telling the story in a succinct way?
Well, you have to have faith in the jury and trust the jury that they're going to get it. They're going to put the pieces together. So every visual should make one point and one point only. You should not try to have one visual make multiple points, tell your whole case. It's like when I'll just give you an example. When these medical illustrator companies, they want to give you like a surgical board and put like all six or eight steps of the surgery on one poster. I hate that. It's confusing. You don't know what you're looking at. It's, you know, so I'd rather have, you know, eight slides. Now, maybe I'll pay them to do the one so I don't have to go pay as many fees. And then I will just cut and paste that into eight different slides so that each step can be shown separately. If we want to do that, I may just get a model spine and get the doctor to have a scalpel or equipment and show what they did. But I think even simpler visuals like photographs, videos, it's so much easier to say, here's a picture, you know, what does this picture show? Well, this is me, you know, running on the beach. Tell me about that time when you're running on the beach. What is it you liked about that? What's this other picture? Well, oh, that's a picture of him sitting at the beach while the rest of us are running. Well, what? Well, he couldn't join us. You know, how did that affect him? You know, that kind of thing. Just those visuals make it a lot better. And of course, videos are really, really good. You know, videos of them doing things before they get hurt, and then videos of them struggling to get better or not being able to do the things the same, I think are really, really useful, really real.
I do think, especially with experts, if they're going to read something from the stand out loud, like, I don't know, a rule or something from the driver handbook or something like that, to put it on a visual so the jury can read along helps move it along faster, right? So you can, because imagine someone's just reading to you a paragraph. One, you don't know what's important in that paragraph. So you're thinking, you're trying to listen to everything and then you get lost in it. And I will say, anytime someone tries to read something to me, they read way too fast and I can't follow along. So if I can read along with it, it's much easier. And so if you can put up just whatever they're reading and highlight what you want them to take away from it, then it just makes the witness move faster. You don't have to read it a second time. You don't have to look at the jury and they're just like, their eyes are rolling back in their head because they're so confused by what was being read. So visuals for experts are equally, if not more important.
Absolutely. And it also keeps them on track when you're using a visual plan. Now, and there's different ways to do that. I mean, one, you can make what's called a document deconstruction board where you can get a poster that has like an image of, say, the commercial driver's license manual and then the quote blown up that you want read and maybe like an interpretation. You know, you can have all that on there. Or you can just have a PDF of that document that you hook up your HDMI cord to your laptop and put up there and then highlight the part that you're reading. And that way the document's up there on the screen. Or you can have it printed and use an IPVO or an Elmo and put it up and highlight. But no matter what you do, you do want to have that text up there so that, you know, different jurors read things at different paces. They might want to go look at it again. Sometimes you want to use the IPVO or the PDF so you can show that you're not just taking things out of context. Sometimes you're not as worried about that. You know, frankly, sometimes you've had time and a budget to make a bunch of really cool exhibits, and sometimes you're trying a case on more of a budget, and so you're just scanning things in and putting them up on your screen. But no matter how you do it, you need to go and put the exhibit up and highlight what you want read, and that way the jurors can read it. And, you know, take time to make sure different people read differently. Some people need to read more than once. That you leave it on the screen between questions, maybe take a little pause, make sure that everyone can read it and understand it.
Yeah, I am a big fan of mixing up the media. So doing one thing on the IPVO, doing one thing on a screen, doing another thing on a flip chart, just because it keeps it more animated and it keeps it more active. And I would say if you have just a PowerPoint, I would be worried about that, because PowerPoints get repetitive, they get dull, unless you can really work on your visuals to make them different colors, to make them stand out from one thing to the next thing. You know, you don't want it all to be the same. Otherwise, I would say mix up your media as much as you can.
The other problem with PowerPoint is it's a little bit less dynamic, because you have to have the slides in that order. And sometimes, you know, the witness kind of riffs a little bit. You want to follow up on that, but then you got to go forward a few slides, or, you know, maybe create something on the fly. You know, I like some PowerPoint's good for some things. You know me, I like just taking my PDFs and putting them up on the screen of the document and then highlighting what I want to highlight. I think it just shows a real command of the evidence when you do that. But I also like creating posters. I also like writing things down. I like mixing up the, you know, getting one time we'll do the PDF, another time we'll use the IPVO or the ELMO, depending on what courtroom you're in, and highlight with an actual physical paper document. Sometimes we'll bring out a book. I think just mixing it up that way. I think a book sometimes has more authority than a PDF document somehow psychologically. So if I'm going to bring out, let's say, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations, you know, I may put a PDF on the screen or may have a poster, but I will at least get the physical book and hand it to the witness and have the witness said, this is a reliable authority on what the rules are. These are the governmental regulations, you know, whatever my predicate is to use that as a learned treatise. But I think having the physical object is so important.
Speaking of physical objects, one of the mixed media that you can use are actually physical objects. So doctors bringing in a spine. I had a client who lost a leg once bring in all the different kinds of prosthetic legs he had and hold them up and explain how they work to the jury. Michael, you had something with a duck. I know you talked about it on a podcast.
Yeah, we were talking about the sitting duck rolls at a trucking company. And so we had a rubber duck. And actually, I used it to create a little mystery, because I said, and you're going to learn about rubber ducks. And I put the rubber duck on the counsel table and left it there. And they didn't hear for another day what it was about. So they were kind of wondering. In fact, after the trial, I got a golden duck in my office now that our team got us. One of the clients wanted the rubber duck, so we gave him the rubber duck. You know, and I will say it also makes it easier. You know, when Sonia Rodriguez and I were trying a premises case in Austin, you know, rather than just trying to describe all the safety measures they could do, you know, I had a bucket of paint and a paintbrush. And one of the things you could have done, and I put out a bucket of paint, is you could have painted this red and put, you know, do not park in this area. Another thing you could have done, I brought out orange traffic cones. You could have put orange traffic cones here and made people stop behind them. And, you know, in that way. And then we also had like a magnetic board with a picture of it. And then we had little magnetic safer designs. And you could put this here or you could put that there. But it's visual, it's engaging. And rather than trying to spend 10 minutes describing it and quibbling over words, you just put the picture up. Same for, you know, if say you have a crash reconstructionist. If you can create either a 3D model, ideally, but if not 3D model, at least like a big blow up of the scene, and then you have model vehicles. If you have your, you know, if you try to get an animation and the other side's fighting you, it can take a long time to lay a predicate for an animation. You can really easily say, does this picture fairly accurately represent the scene? Can you take these two cars and show us what happened? It's quicker, it's easier. I think it's more persuasive because it's more interactive.
Yeah, I think so too. And especially in today's day with like fake AI videos and stuff, I think jurors are actually more suspicious of videos than they used to be, especially animations that look, I mean, they're animations. They're obviously not real videos of the crash. And so I think people are more suspicious of something that's a created video than someone just taking two toy cars and running them into each other on a big blown up map, because it feels more real. It feels more, okay, this is what really happened. This isn't some trick that this lawyer's trying to play on me.
Yeah, and I think it's simple and it helps us do things more quickly. I think the other thing where I've seen people really lose juries is, you know, they're going to put the expert on the stand and then they spend 20 to 30 minutes on qualifications because they think it's going to really pump up the expert. And by the time they're done, the jurors just have lost focus.
Well, the jurors don't know why you're doing it. I mean, they don't know what they're supposed to remember about this or what, like they don't know that you have to lay a qualification predicate for your repeal or whatever. And so when we talk about expert qualifications, this is a great time to use your flip chart and you write down, you know, a couple of key things you want them to know, especially if you're going to compare your expert's qualifications to the defense expert's qualifications, but a couple of key things to know. This guy is a certified accident reconstructionist. He teaches accident reconstruction at the local school, the local college. He has written 10 publications on, you don't need to go through the names. He's written 10 publications on accident reconstruction. And those are your qualifications. He's been doing it for 53 years. Those are your qualifications. And that's enough. And then you've written it down and the jury says, okay, yeah, this guy knows what he's talking about. This professor of accident reconstruction or this certified, whatever his qualifications are. And then you move on. You've done it in 3 minutes and you've said what you needed to say about his qualifications for the purposes of your appeal.
And if somehow you think you have to do more, do it at the end. After you, so if the jury's going to go to sleep, they've already been. So, you know, give the very basics. And that's the thing. I've had someone like, I've seen defense lawyers, like have the expert read every publication they had to the juror. And, you know, it's like, it is so painful. I love it when they're doing on the other side. But I think if you have let's say we have a case about whether you can see reflective tape on a side of a trailer when it's at a certain angle, and the experts published a paper on that. Now, you published 31 papers on this. Was one of those papers on exactly on this topic? Then, you know, but even then, that's like another 30 seconds.
Right.
Tell us about that paper. Well, we did research. We got trucks. We got trailers. And we found that at certain angles, you can't see them. Okay, we'll talk about that later. You know, we'll talk more about that later. But, you know, you get into that. But it's got to be something relevant. And it doesn't, you know, I've seen people just bring up, you know, where did you go to undergrad? You know, the fact is, you got a PhD, you got a PhD. You don't need to talk about where you went to undergrad, you know.
Unless it's somewhere super impressive where people are like, oh, well, they went to Harvard. Okay. Or, oh, okay, well, they're from MIT. But great. I mean, if it's just, you know, any other, if it's not Harvard or MIT, you don't need to talk about where they went.
Yeah. But are you talking about where they got their PhD or wherever they got their most impressive, you know, like if you have someone that went to Texas A&M on the jury, if your expert went to Texas A&M, there is a Aggie network, you wouldn't want to mention that. But you don't need to go into great detail about all their everything. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, the other thing I think people forget too is that you don't have to do it in any specific order. I mean, you have to get the qualifications out a little bit in the beginning, typically, because you want to show that they're qualified. You don't want to have a break to take the witness on voir dire to prove that they're qualified. So you want to have a little bit at the front, but especially if they've written a paper or done a specific study or have specific qualifications on something that you're going to be talking about later with the witness, you can talk about those qualifications when you get to that topic. So if you've written it down on a flip chart, you can flip back to your chart and say, oh, you know what? Did you actually write a paper about reflective tape and the angles that you can see reflective tape as you're asking questions about the angles of reflective tape? So the jury remembers why it's relevant and you're getting out the qualifications. And so it's not all at once in a boring way. So you can do it later on in the examination. You don't have to do it all right at the beginning.
Yeah, I've really been using Joe Freed's. I mean, we were doing quick trials before Joe Freed called it speed trial, but he's got, you know, great results and he's really thought about how to put it through. And I don't think he likes the word speed trial as much anymore because it's not about going fast. It's about being efficient and about telling your story, no more, no less. But, you know, I like his phrasing, which is like, you know, who are you? What are you here to talk about? What makes you the right person to talk about it? So it's like, you know, who are you? I'm Dr. So-and-so. What are you here to talk about? Crash reconstruction. Okay, well, what is crash reconstruction? Well, you're going to look at evidence, figuring out what happened in a crash. Okay, well, one of the things the jury needs to know to do their jobs in this case is, you know, what did the layout of this crash scene look like? Is that something you can help us with? And they say yes. And I know, you know, so I'd write Dr. Reyes, what is he here to talk about? If it's, let's say, Dr. Michael Reyes, who's a great reconstructionist, and that, so I'd write, you know, the layout of the scene. Well, another thing we need to find out is what happened. Is that something you can help us with? Yes, including how fast the vehicles were going, including did people have time to stop? And then, you know, third thing is, did anyone violate any of the traffic rules? Can you help us with that? And so I'd write, like, hopefully no more than three, four things that they're going to talk about. So that way we have context. well, what makes you the right person to talk about that? And you have to prep them. Like, that means, how are you qualified? And then again, you want to, like, Dr. Reyes, what makes him qualified or what makes him the right person to talk about? I use it like, what qualifies him to talk about this? And then you got to practice with your person, you know, to say, these are the bullet points you're gonna have. And then sometimes if you're in a court where they're going to let in CVs, because CVs are technically hearsay, but a lot of times both sides want to get them in. So I'll let yours in if you let mine in. Are the rest of your qualifications fairly and accurately set out on Exhibit 32? If someone wanted to read more in the details, could they read it there yet? And not sit there and read the whole darn CV to the jury. But I find that just putting it in context, making it super simple, is really, really helpful. And that way, and then you just go, okay, well, the first thing you're talking about is this, and you ask questions about that. And you go, well, on the next, then you go back to your list. Now, the next thing we're going to ask you about is this. And you explain to the jury how this also, through your questions, how this relates to the job that they have to do at the end of the case.
Right, right. And I think that that's so important because most of the people on your jury have never been on a jury. They don't really know what to expect. They don't know how they receive evidence. They don't know when they receive evidence. They just don't really know how this is all going to go. And so as you're presenting your case, you're teaching the jury how to understand the case. And so if you have an outline for every witness that's the same basic questions, who are you? What are you going to talk about? Tell me what you're talking about, right? And you do that same order for every witness, it teaches the jury how to understand the evidence that you're presenting. And it makes it go faster because then the jury's like, yep, name who they are and what they're here to talk about. I'm going to hear that right at the beginning for every witness so that I can really contextualize what I'm hearing. Because if you start with, here's the qualifications of this person, the jury's sitting there going, okay, what am I supposed to know about that? Why do I need to know this for what I'm about to hear? So doing that little roadmap, you know, Mark Lanier draws this little cartoon roadmaps. I can't draw cartoons. You don't need to be able to draw cartoons to do this. You can write it on a flip chart, the roadmap, but you do it for every single witness because it teaches the jury how to understand the case and how to understand the evidence being presented. You can even do it with cross-examinations. I mean, it works for every single witness.
Absolutely. Now, I think, you know, this is important with any witness, but I think it's 100 times more important if you're going to present the witness through an edited video deposition.
Why is that?
You know, talking to jurors after trial, it is just so painful to watch videos. You know, when we're watching TV, we're used to, I think it's like, there's no same camera angle for more than like 7 or 8 seconds. Nobody's just watching the same face for more than 7 or 8 seconds. Even if someone keeps talking, they put up other images, they'll switch the angle, they'll put the questioner, then they'll put the person answering the questions, they'll put up graphics. So to just sit there and watch a 45-minute video of a talking head is painful. It is really hard to focus. And I think sometimes, you know, we under-edit our videos. We think everything needs to be in there. We think all the context needs to be in there. We forget that there's other witnesses, that they don't have to be, not every witness has to say the same thing over and over again. And it's so easy to have really long videos. And you don't think it's that long when you're going through it, but then when you're sitting in court and you're seeing that those jurors fall asleep, you really regret not taking the time to cut it down more. So I think on video depositions, I think it is so important to cut them down to really as little time as possible to persuasively make your point. And then if you can, to get visuals mixed into your video deposition. But you have to be very cognizant while you're doing that because, you know, you have to make sure you've laid your evidentiary predicate. You know, if the other side objects to what you're putting up there and you didn't lay the predicate right, or you thought you did and the judge said you didn't, then you have to figure out, can you still use that video? Let's say you use Zoom and you're sharing the screen, so you have the document up and this the witness in the little corner. If the judge says you can't have the document up, what do you do? And we had that happen where the other side objected every time we had the document up and we had laid all our predicates. And then when it was their turn, they were just horrified that we would make the same objection and they couldn't just have their experts hearsay report on the screen the whole time. The case settled, but they were having to go get a video person to take that little square and make it really big and just have like this pixelated, really out of focus talking head with no context. It was awesome. And so, you know, I encourage people to try to use visuals to mix it up. Maybe consider, because you're doing it on video, kind of asking the question with and without, which is, I don't know if you can get your witnesses to do that. But just be really sure you know what your evidentiary predicates are. You know, if you're going to use a photograph, does this photograph fairly accurately depict X? Would it be helpful to the jury in explaining why? and then make sure that you lay that predicate, and the same for whatever your predicate is for your visual aids. If you're just putting stuff up there and you don't lay the predicate, the judge is not going to let it in. And then you're going to possibly not be able to play that part. You may have to only play the audio or play something really pixelated or just put a picture and play the audio of the witness's head. It would be, or even go back to the old fashioned, like reading the deposition transcript in court.
Yeah. You know, people, if you feel like you can talk to a witness before their deposition, I tell witnesses, I might have to ask you questions in more than one way. And it seems like I'm asking the same question over and over again. And it's just because I just tell them I'm legally required to. So try not to get impatient with me. I'm going to ask you with the visual. I'm going to ask you without the visual. And it's just because the judge might require me to do that. And I don't want to have to do this again. That's what I tell them. I don't want to have to do this again. I don't want to have to call you at trial. So just let me get through this and it'll be better for us all if we can do it. If you can't talk to a witness ahead of time before their deposition, I tell people on the record what I'm doing. Like if they start to lose patience with me, I say, I know this is really tough, but we really have to do it this way so that we can get a clear, clean record of your testimony. So we don't have to do it again. And I don't have to try to call you at trial. And so just bear with me. We have to do it with the visual. We have to do it without the visual. I just explain it out loud there in the deposition if they're losing patience with me. Because the last thing you want is you do it one way with no visual. Then you're doing it with the visuals. And the witness says things like, I already told you X, Y, and Z. I just said X, Y, and Z. If they say that, that kind of ruins your video when they're saying, I just said that, and you've cut out the piece where they just said that. So, you know, don't be afraid to tell the witness what you're doing. I mean, it's okay to tell them what's going on.
One last little tip on video depositions, and I actually had an argument with a videographer, is for some reason, some of these videographers think that you're required to put the date and the time down the bottom of the video. Check your local court rules. Most jurisdictions don't actually require that. And the problem with that is when you edit your videos later, and you're going to have to edit them because there's going to be objections, there's going to be just irrelevant testimony that comes in there, you're skipping around. And the jury sees it and they start wondering what's in there. It's distracting. It's one thing they're looking at, oh, look at the time skip, rather than paying attention to what's going on there. So I'm more and more asking my videographers not to do that. They don't all, some of them in New Mexico insist you have to. I was like, no, you don't.
It's amazing how many times I get people who are not lawyers tell me that something's legally required. And I'm sitting there like, okay, I'm the lawyer. I'm telling you it's not. Someone told them, you know, that it was. I think the big takeaway, Mike, what do you think the big takeaway from the 30-minute witness is for people listening?
The case is about the jury. And if you don't have the jury engaged, awake, and entertained, you're not going to get the result you want in your case.
Well, I'm really excited about this new trial series we're doing. I can't wait to see what the next topic's going to be. You know, I really would love to hear feedback from the audience. If there's a trial topic that you've heard us mention in other episodes, or that you just want to know, like, Michael, you know, you talked about the 30-minute expert witness. I want to do a deep dive in that, right? Like, let's really, really focus on that and tell me how you've done it in real life trials. We would love to do what you think is helpful, the listener. So please reach out to us at Trial Lawyer Nation and tell us what you want to hear next for our trial series.
And the last thing is, you and I are both speaking at the Academy of Truck Accident Attorneys Symposium in Austin, Texas in September. It's going to be a great program. I know because I've worked really hard along with Andy Young, Michael Leeserman, and Joe Freed to plan it. And we've put a lot of work into it. It's going to be a great program. It's the 18th through the 20th of September in Austin. So we really encourage everyone to come out. You're going to learn a lot. You can come say hi. We love it when people come say hi to us. And in the meantime, any questions, any requests for topics, just send them to michael@cowanlaw.com. And we'd be love to have it on the show. Well, Mallory, thank you. And for all our listeners, thank you for listening again on Trial Lawyer Nation. We'll see you next time.